Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, February 16th, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodTimes.com is Cindy McCormick. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll hear from Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner will speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times and Andy Tomolonis from SouthCoastToday.com. Now, a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the islands. Cindy, the town of Falmouth has shut down its wind turbines, but it still has to pay for them. This week, we heard about a deal the town has worked out to reduce its debt on one of the turbines.
Yeah, that's the Wind One, and the town had owed $1.5 million debt to the State Clean Energy Center. But after a closed-door session Monday, Board of Selectmen Chairwoman Susan Moran announced that the debt for Wind One has been negotiated down to $178,000. And they negotiated this deal with state officials, and a request for $178,000 will be made at spring annual town meeting.
So that's substantial, from $1.5 million down to $178,000, but there's still a lot more money out there on this.
Yeah, the Wind One debt actually totaled $6.5 million, and the town actually took a municipal bond to cover $5 million of the cost, and that comes to a payment from the taxpayers of $385,000 per year. There's no negotiating of that commitment, but the Clean Energy Center debt of $1.5 million would have required additional payments of $110,000 per year for the next 15 years. So that was a big drop in cost to the town that they're able to negotiate this deal.
And there's still, that's just really looking at Wind One now.
Yeah, Wind Two has a debt of $4.9 million. That was negotiated down, however, to $2.9 million. And right now that loan is interest-free, which also helps a lot. The money is due in full by July of 2029.
Okay. So it looks like the town getting out of some of its debt there as it tries to figure out, it's still figuring out what to do with those turbines as well.
Right, and negotiating on whether one could be used by someone, other authority at some point.
And I think the town,
different location.
That's right. They've allocated some funds for a study to figure out what to do, to try to figure out whether they're going to relocate them or reuse one of those turbines as a cell tower even.
Right, exactly.
There's one more lawsuit still out there, too. Some citizens who want to see these things started up again.
And it's this plan that was supposed to bring, you know, clean, renewable energy to the town has just resulted in, like, some major, major headaches and costs for the town.
Costs, big costs.
Right.
Cindy, you wrote a story this week about the flu and its continuing impact. It seems like everybody knows somebody who's been knocked down by the flu this winter.
Yeah, and it's continuing to rage across the state and across Cape Cod. I'm just hearing every day about people getting the flu. And this flu started in late December. It was an early start. It was about 10 days early start this year, and it's still going on. And then tragically, the Department of Public Health officials said this week that a child under the age of 10 died in Essex County of complications from the flu. This is the first pediatric flu-related death in Massachusetts this year. There were two last year, and the CDC said earlier this month that there have been 63 pediatric deaths across the United States. Now, pediatric deaths are the only ones that are really reportable for flu, where all the states are required to report the deaths. But it's estimated that, you know, that 250 to 1,100 Massachusetts residents die each year of flu complications, particularly pneumonia.
And there are parts of the country now that have seen this in a much bigger epidemic. I know you were talking about Atlanta in your article.
Yeah, a hospital in Atlanta had to set up a tent outside to handle. It was like became a temporary ER to handle all the flu cases. And they said everything was high tech inside, and it looked like a hospital inside, but on the outside it looked like a tent. And this was a mobile structure that wasn't there ordinarily, and they did this to handle the flu.
We haven't seen that on the Cape, though.
No, not on the Cape. Doctors at Cape Cod Hospital say the hospital is pretty full, you know, with as it usually is at this time of year. And, you know, the cases seem, you know, a little bit more severe. This is a strain. The strain that's going around this year is H3N2, which can cause more sickness. It's a little bit trickier to treat. But they said, you know, it's not an emergency type situation. They also have other respiratory illnesses that they're dealing with. People are hospitalized, and gastrointestinal illnesses as well. So, you know, and it's mainly affecting people 65 and older. And adding to this is the fact that this flu, the vaccine this year was such a bad match.
So tell me a little bit about that match with the vaccine.
Well, the CDC officials knew it wasn't a good match, but now a journal called Eurosurveillance is reporting that among working-age adults in Canada, the vaccine is only 10% effective against H3N2, and they're questioning whether that's even statistically significant, like whether or not you get the flu shot. However, public officials here in Massachusetts say it's very important to get the flu shot because it does prevent the spread of some flu. It also appears to be more effective against the strain B, type B that is going around now. And it's also a doctor at Cape Cod Healthcare said that that was Dr. Kevin Mulroy said that if you get the flu, the flu vaccine could help it be a little less severe.
And there are a few things that people can do to try to prevent getting the flu still.
Yeah, you can. Well, for one thing, you know, we all know now to cough into our elbows, to sneeze into our elbows, you know, rather than into the air or our hands, because these flu droplets, you know, the virus lives in these droplets, and they can even live for a while on doorknobs and surfaces. So if your hands touch it, you can, even if you're not shaking someone's hand, you could leave some flu for someone else to pick up. And and also, they say, to contact a doctor if you feel, you know, the flu symptoms coming on, the body. Body aches, a sore throat, the fevers, and see about getting an antiviral like Tamiflu, which can reduce the length and severity of the flu. One good note is that Dr. Mulroy at Cape Cod Hospital said that they're seeing fewer requests for fewer hospital-based prescriptions for Tamiflu. But he's warning that, you know, that doesn't mean that, you know, they're hoping that means that flu cases might be starting to go down, but they're not counting on it. And Barnstable County still has plenty, and there's still plenty of flu vaccine out there, and Barnstable County has plenty of flu shots available.
Another story this week, the utility company Eversource has submitted a new 5-year plan for herbicide use under power lines. This is a long-running story. Many towns have expressed concern about this program.
Yeah, this is a new 5-year plan for controlling vegetation under the power lines on Cape Cod and Martha's Vineyard. And to the dismay, but not the surprise, of conservationists and local officials, the plan once again would employ the use of herbicides. And this plan would go from 2018 to 2022. It requires the approval of the State Department of Agricultural Resources, which has two public hearings scheduled for March on the Cape.
So those public hearings, can you tell us about them? There's one, I think, March 1st in Sandwich.
Yeah, there'll be one March 1st in Sandwich and one March 6th at Chatham Town Hall. And Laura Kelly, she's founder of the environmental group Protect Our Cape Aquifer, is disappointed that that local people haven't been able to stop the application of herbicide, but she's pleased the public hearings will be followed by 90-minute information sessions. She says it's huge that these state officials will at least listen to what people have to say about the herbicides, because the fear is that they're going to affect health and the fragile ecosystem, especially since there's the chemical that's used in Roundup. Mm-hmm. And this is, the glyphosate won't be part of the mix for backpack sprayers on the Cape and Martha's Vineyard this year. That's according to Eversource spokesman Michael Durand. But it will be used as part of cut stump treatment. Once they've cut the stumps, they will be using it around it to control the vegetation that springs up around it.
And there's
it.
Concern about these chemicals making their way into the aquifer.
Right, right. Yeah,
the Cape has a very shallow aquifer.
Yeah, sole source aquifer, so it's a big concern about that. Now, the town of Brewster managed to delay herbicide spraying last fall with a preliminary injunction through Barnstable Superior Court, but the town eventually lost its court battle against Eversource. There was also a bill in the legislature that was sponsored by State Senator Julian Sear and State Representative Sarah Peek that would have allowed municipalities to offer a no-spray agreement with Eversource. It didn't make it out of committee by deadline and won't be taken up by this current session. However, Sierra is optimistic because the pesticide bill submitted by State Senator Bruce Tarr advanced favorably in the legislature.
So just as before we leave this, I want to remind folks then there's a hearing in Sandwich March 1st, Sandwich Town Hall, also March 6th at Chatham Town Hall Annex, and they are accepting written comments until March 16th, which is another opportunity for folks to weigh in there. We are going to speak now with Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Sarah, river herring are in steep decline. It's an issue around the state and along the coast and on the vineyard. Tell us about this.
Yeah, some really bad news. As you said, the steep decline, and some are calling it a historic low for river herring throughout the state and here on the vineyard. And this was the subject of kind of a summit-like meeting on Monday at the newly completed Tribal Community Center in Aquinnah for the Wampanoag Tribe of Gayhead Aquinnah. And, you know, herring spend most of their lives in the ocean, but they swim up into freshwater streams to spawn every 3 years, which is where we usually see them on the vineyard here. And they were historically abundant, according to documentation in the past. At one point, 1.5 million herring passed through the herring run in Aquinnah every year. And according to data that the tribe collected, about 23,000 fish made the journey last year. So that's obviously a really big decline. And these declines have been seen at herring runs, as you said, throughout Massachusetts along the coastline. And some factors are habitat loss, you know, climate change. A lot of people at the meeting this week on the vineyard pointed to overfishing. Mm. They said that, you know, large trawlers in New England waters are something they see as a really big factor. One fisherman said that those trawlers can gather 100,000 pounds of herring in one, you know, one sweep of the net. So, you know, there's a, some clearly some different factors going on, but the state is looking at ways to improve the fishery, including, you know, constructing and repairing fish ladders and conserving spawning areas where they come in to spawn every year. And there's been talk about possibly protecting herring with the Endangered Species Act. So there's some different solutions being looked at. And, you know, another thing that's being used to monitor the species and how the Wampanoag tribe in Aquinnah got that 23,000 number is kind of these underwater herring cams that they have been using. There's one that was installed in 2016 at the herring run in Aquinnah, and it uses automated software to help them get a look at how many herring are coming through. And there's some there's others throughout the state. And it's also, you know, the, I've seen the one in Aquinnah, and it's also just really interesting looking at what's going on beneath the water, too, beyond the herring, you know, seeing striped bass and entire otter families and cormorants. So they have that installed here to keep an eye on the population and keep an eye on what happens this year and in the future to continue to monitor what's happening. But clearly the information they've gathered points to something kind of alarming going on with this species.
Sarah, before I let you go, I also want to ask you about a story on your website that was popping this week. It's a story about a wedding, and it has a celebrity angle.
Yeah, we had a wedding announcement on our site that got a lot more traffic than normal, and that was the marriage of Chris Fisher, who's a Chilmark farmer and chef. He also has written a lot for the Gazette, some really beautiful columns about food and family. And he got married this week to Amy Schumer, who's a well-known comedian and actress and writer, and they had been dating. They got married on Tuesday, on the 13th, in Malibu. Amy posted pictures on her Instagram, and it looked like a beautiful ceremony overlooking the water. And this is obviously of interest to people on the vineyard who know Chris, and he's a Native Islander and know his family and him, but also really made news far beyond the vineyard because of the celebrity connection. So definitely got a lot of traffic and was buzzing. The news was making the rounds this week. So we wish them well, and congratulations to Chris and Amy.
Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. Sarah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Bye.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point, and we're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. And on the phone with us right now is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Hiya, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, Chatham selectmen have rejected a change to the school agreement regarding realigning the elementary schools. This is a story we spoke about a little bit from the other side, on the Harwich side, a couple of weeks ago. Tell us what's happening here.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, as you said, Harwich selectmen voted to back the school committee's proposal. What they want to do is change the regional agreement between the two towns that created the Monomoy School District. And the change would allow the school committee to reconfigure the grade alignment in the Harwich and Chatham elementary schools. Now, currently, the agreement requires that students attend elementary schools in their own town, but enrollment in Chatham took a bit of a nosedive this year, dropped about 12% in kindergarten, and they had to eliminate one kindergarten class. And meanwhile, Harwich Elementary School has basically all the students it can handle right now. There's no indication that these demographic trends are going to change, so the school committee really wanted the ability to alter the grade configuration so the class sizes could remain more or less equal in the two schools. And in order to do that, they have to change the regional agreement. And so they were proposing to go to town meeting this May with a change that would allow the school committee, with the approval of the two towns' boards of selectmen, to make those changes and not have to go back to town meeting again to make those changes every time they want to alter the grade configuration. They say that'll make it a quicker reaction if they have to go through town meeting. It basically takes about a year to implement, and they say that they want to be able to act more quickly than that. Some of their solutions could involve Harwich students attending classes in Chatham. It could involve a two-tier system with lower grades in one school and upper grades in the other. And they haven't made any of those decisions yet. They say they want to be ready to make those decisions. But the Chatham selectmen decided this week they don't like that that plan. They say that when the regionalization was brought to town meeting about 5 years ago, and, you know, if you remember, it passed in Chatham by a very slim margin, something like 61 votes. People in Chatham were promised that they'd be able to retain their own elementary school. And selectmen didn't like going back on that promise. They also said taking the authority to make these decisions away from town meeting was not something they wanted to see. So basically, you know, the selectmen decided that they didn't weren't going to back this change, and they sent the proposal back to the school committee. Chairman Nancy Scott says that that group is going to review the comments made at the selectmen's meeting and the comments made by the Harwich selectmen, who were split over this decision. They'll be reviewing those at the school committee's February 28th meeting and decide how they want to proceed at this point.
I saw one comment in that article from somebody in Chatham saying that if you take this, if there's a danger of these kids moving, going to school elsewhere, then you're really hurting town of Chatham's effort to bring young families into town.
There was several comments like that. And, you know, in the last few weeks, there's been a lot of discussion in Chatham about housing, the housing situation here and how tight it is, how unaffordable it is to families. And people say if you know, one of the reasons families might move here is because of the quality of the elementary school. And if you take and if you make that questionable, you take away a town elementary school, you know, that might discourage families from moving here. And that's something that obviously we don't want to do right now.
Mm. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With me is Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. Cindy, the Dennis Yarmouth Regional School District is grappling with some difficult budget issues.
Yeah, they're looking at a proposed budget for 2019 that would be $62 million with no new services added. That would be an increase of 6.2% over the current budget for this year. And that's mainly, they say, the drivers are employee health care and busing.
Tell us some more about
what
they're facing.
Well, they're facing, the same time that these costs are just rising, as I say, rising with no new services, state funds are dwindling. There is a $200,000 drop in state aid, and nearly $250,000 used from a deficiency and excess fund is not available this year. And school committee member Brian Sullivan said, we're in a bind here. And one of the big issues is the disparities between the two towns, Yarmouth and Dennis. Yarmouth taxpayers will be once again asked to shoulder a higher percentage of the cost burden. And this is based on a regional requirement for funding based on student enrollment, since Yarmouth enrollment is much larger, and it's actually rising. Since 2016, the number of Yarmouth students went up 39, while Dennis went down 38. That meant that last year, Yarmouth voters had to approve a Proposition 2.5 override to meet the budget. Mm. And the Board of Selectmen in Yarmouth are concerned that this is just going to be part of an ongoing cycle of overrides.
That's no way to fund a school district, but just by continually passing Prop 2.5 overrides.
Right. Yes. And so some school committee members want a regional subcommittee to resume efforts to come up with a new regional agreement that will be more fair between the two towns and won't require on the cycle of overrides. The school committee votes March 5th on the final budget. As of right now, according to the proposal, the Yarmouth assessment would be $33 million and the Dennis assessment would be $17 million. Dennis was able to approve the current year's budget without the need for an override.
Hmm. So a lot to figure out there for the school district. We're going to speak now with Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, hello.
Good morning.
Josh, the field is set for the upcoming April elections. Tell us what's happening.
It is. We've got four contested races in the April 10th annual town election out here on Nantucket for the Board of Selectmen, the Planning Board, the School Committee, and the Harbor and Shellfish Advisory Board. There are a number of other uncontested races and a couple of ballot questions, but for the town's lead policymaking body, the Board of Selectmen, incumbent Dawn Holgate is running against a political newcomer, Sean Cabral. He's 42, and he says that he wants to bring some more accountability and a more representative voice of the people to the island in a seat, in his, if he wins a seat on the Board of Selectmen. And Dawn Hill Holgate is would be running for her second term. She says there's a lot of unfinished business she'd like to continue, including working on the potential construction of a new town nursing home, starting to negotiate a new contract for the municipal landfill, and a number of other initiatives, including some sustainability initiatives that she's looking at. Planning Board also has a seat up for election. Longtime incumbent Linda Williams is running against retired attorney Fritz McClure. He ran unsuccessfully last year against Planning Board member Nat Lowell. And there's a two-year seat also up on the Planning Board. That is David Callahan, who is currently an interim Planning Board member, running against, again, another political newcomer, Judith Wegner, in that seat. So it's a lot of races on the ballot this year. Not as many candidates as we had in the past. Sometimes we've had five or six candidates for a seat or two on the selectman, but it looks like it's going to be a pretty active political season leading into April.
Josh, the island has a marine mammal stranding team, and it was recently recognized by the federal government. What does this mean?
It means that they are able to do a lot more to help stranded marine mammals out here on the island. As you said, Nantucket has had a marine mammal stranding team for a number of years, but back in 2014, it was essentially decertified. It lost its relationship with the New England Aquarium, which is what it worked under, because the aquarium decided to sort of shift its resources in a different direction. So the stranding team pretty much out here for the last couple of years, if they were notified of a stranding of a seal or a whale or a dolphin, couldn't do much other than call the mainland and wait for help. Now they fought for a couple of years to get this federal recognition, which means they can go out. They can approach dead mammals, dead marine mammals, and take measurements. They can approach live mammals and work to disentangle them or get them back into open water, and they can collect data. And as you can imagine, being 30 miles out to sea, Nantucket does see its share of entanglements and stranded marine mammals. Just last year, a pod of right whales and humpback whales was spotted just a couple of hundred yards off the south shore. Now we've had a couple of strandings of dead mammals as well out here. So it's good news for the marine mammals and good news for the marine mammal stranding team.
Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Thank you, Josh.
Thank you.
Cindy McCormick of the Cape Cod Times. Cindy, Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant has revealed it's had a flaw in the way it's been testing its emergency systems, and that could have put the public at jeopardy.
Well, yeah, this is a procedural flaw in to test emergency system to contain radiation. It violated federal regulations, and critics of Pilgrim say it could have left the public unprotected if there had been a radiological release had occurred while the test was being done. Entergy, which is Pilgrim's owner and operator, told the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in a letter sent in late January that the flaw was discovered November 26 when workers prepared to test a standby system. This test had been done with the procedural error in place several times in the past 3 years. And Mary Lampert, who's a Pilgrim opponent, said that we would have been out of luck, that's her quote, in an emergency if radiation need to be filtered. However, Entergy spokesman Patrick O'Brien said that there has been no adverse impact to the plant or safety. David Lochbaum, who's director of the Nuclear Safety Program for the Union of Concerned Scientists, agreed danger to the public was minimal since testing does not take long.
So it's kind of hard to understand. There's so many things that happen at this plant, and it sounds like this particular procedure was a testing procedure, and that in the process of testing it, they took offline some of the emergency systems that they would have depended on if something happened.
Yeah, they disabled both trains of gas treatment that contain large fans that would drive contaminated air through filters in case of emergency, but they would disable both at the same time, but they were always supposed to keep one online in case of an emergency, and they did not do that. That was the big issue.
And I think the overriding question with many of these stories from Pilgrim is that it raises issues of questionable oversight and decision-making at the plant.
Yeah, Pilgrim is classified by federal standards as one of the worst-performing reactors in the nation. It's just one step above mandatory shutdown, and it is scheduled for shutdown May 31st, 2019.
Moving on here, the town of Eastham has a new policy. A new policy that I'm fascinated by. It's intended to raise engagement by young people in town government, but it's not without controversy.
Right. Well, as we all know, the Cape is aging rapidly, especially the outer and lower Cape, even faster than the rest of the Cape. But the town of Eastham is trying to make sure that young voices are being heard. In December, the selectmen enacted a policy allowing residents as young as 14 to be voting members on town advisory boards and committees. But only two young people have signed on to committees at this point, but it's already created controversy. And as a matter of fact, Finance Committee Chairman Michael Hackworth said it was one of the reasons for his resigning the board in January. In a letter to the town clerk, he said that young people are just like too inexperienced in fiscal matters and capital projects and can't really weigh in on these important subjects.
However, the young people on these boards don't have they're just a member of the board. So it sounds like there's plenty of oversight from the other members of the board.
Well, the new policy actually rules out regulatory boards such as the planning board, the Board of Selectmen, and Zoning Board of Appeals for full voting participation because the boards make decisions that could be subject to litigation and state and federal laws. And as a matter of fact, the 16-year-old member of the Finance Committee, Brendan Hamady, is an ad hoc non-voting member of the Finance Committee. Now, the Board of Selectmen will consider revised policies concerning these younger voters and limiting one to per board or committee. Although, as like I said, it hasn't been like a bunch of kids signing on already. There are two younger people on the committees now. Selectman John Knight said he likes the idea of young people becoming involved because we are creating their town. And other issues people are saying, these boards are so, heavy with older people.
Yes.
Because people in their 20s and 30s are busy establishing careers and working and raising families.
Yes.
So they said, well, if we're going to get the young voice, maybe we have to go down to the teenage level, reach out to the teenagers and get them involved.
I think it's a fascinating experiment, and I'm looking forward to hearing more about what young people get involved there in Eastham.
Yeah, talk about inspiring civic engagement.
We're going to speak with Ed Miller now from the Provincetown Banner. Hello, Ed.
Hi there, Steve.
Ed, Wellfleet's Cahoon Hollow parking lot won't reopen. Folks may remember it collapsed late last summer after some torrential rain.
That's right, Steve. There are four ocean beaches that are managed by the town of Wellfleet, going from south to north: LeCount Hollow, Whitecrest Beach, Cahoon Hollow, and Newcomb Hollow. And last August, after a rainfall of about 5 or more inches in a matter of hours, the town parking lot at Cahoon Hollow, where the Beachcomber restaurant is, collapsed, and people probably remember seeing the photograph of the Honda sedan that went down into a crevasse and had to be rescued the next day. The lot was closed for safety reasons, and town officials have now decided that it will not be reopened. The cost of repairing it, making it safe, estimates ranged to over $1 million, I think. And for a lot with just 35 spaces in it, and that is likely to not be there much longer in any case, I think that they determined that it just wasn't worth it. The problem of beach erosion has been plaguing the town for a while now. All of the parking lots along the ocean there have been losing spaces. Not exactly clear how many, but at least a couple of hundred over the last few years. They're down to about 500 now. And so the whole issue of what to do about parking has become quite a hot one.
Ed, I want to ask you about another story you had this week. It's about the Provincetown Marijuana Dispensary is actually going to be moving its location, its planned location, because it's not there yet.
Well, that's right. The company Heal Incorporated of Newton did get the go-ahead from the selectmen and the planning board to have a medical marijuana dispensary at the site of the Gately McCool funeral home on Harry Kemp Way, in spite of the objections of local residents who said, we don't want it to become Harry Hemp Way. But they agreed at the time that they got that approval that they would not try and expand to include recreational marijuana sales there. In the meantime, the company has decided, as the state, of course, has gone forward with its regulations for recreational sales, the company's decided that that was maybe not the right decision. And so they are now looking at a different location on Shank Painter Road, which is in the town's commercial district and where recreational sales would be theoretically allowed. And the people around Harry Kemp Way are happy about that. But the company still has to go back to the planning board now with for site plan review and to get a special permit for this new location.
Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner. Ed, thanks for joining us this morning.
My pleasure, Steve.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. We're going to go to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back to the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. And on the phone with us right now is George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve. How are you this morning?
Doing very well, George. George, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren spoke this week at the National Congress of American Indians, and she was introduced by an islander.
Yeah, so this appearance for Senator Warren got a lot of attention. What didn't get as much attention is that it was Cheryl Andrews Maltese, the chairwoman of the Wampanoag Tribe of Gayhead Aquinnah, who introduced Senator Warren at that event. Of course, Cheryl was telling us that this was quite an honor for her to be able to introduce the senior senator from Massachusetts. It was quite an appearance for Senator Warren. As many people are aware, President Trump has taken to calling Senator Warren Pocahontas in a derogatory manner. He is, of course, making reference to her heritage as a Native American. She is not on any tribal roll. It was interesting, at her appearance, she did try to cast more light on exactly how this all came about for her, her heritage being brought up. She talks about her mother having Native American blood, and actually her mother and father had to elope because her father's family objected to him marrying someone with Native American blood. So it's an interesting family story. She does acknowledge that she is not on any tribal roll. She also vowed to do all she can in Congress to help Native Americans and help lift them up. So often in our history, Native Americans have been put down in many different ways and their land taken. And so she is promising to be a voice for them in Congress.
George, did you have an opportunity to ask Cheryl Andrews Maltese how she happened to be selected for that role?
I didn't. We just exchanged a brief text messages back and forth where she talked, and, you know, she was traveling, so it was difficult. But she did talk about, you know, just how exciting it was for her. Of course, you know, Cheryl has had some significant roles in the brief period of time where she wasn't serving as chairwoman of the tribe. There was an interim between two of her terms as chairwoman. She did serve in the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington, D.C., so she has held some pretty significant positions for in Indian country. So Warren did also acknowledge the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe in her remarks at the National Congress of American Indians.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. Cindy, the town of Dennis is finding itself at odds with the state over the policy of allowing driving on some of its beaches.
Yeah, for generations of Dennis residents, summer means going off-road on the beach at Crow's Pasture. But the joys of parking or driving on the tidal flats may be a thing of the past if the state succeeds in efforts to enforce coastal management guidelines that would ban vehicles from the exposed tidal flats there at Crow's Pasture. The town of Dennis filed a notice of intent with the DEP for a new management plan, and that would allow off-road vehicles to drive on the tidal flats if there are no endangered piping plover chicks present. And if the chicks are present, the town has come up with a plan plan that would allow escort vehicles to at least take people, to at least take commercial agricultural grant holders out to their grant areas in the flats. But, however, the Department of Environment Protection replied in December that off-road vehicles should not be allowed access to the flats under any conditions, and it says the state has not decided whether they would allow grant holders access to the flats with an escort vehicle or special circumstances like that. The state is saying parking should only be allowed on overland vehicle corridors, which would be located to avoid the tidal flats.
So, and what does the town now say that they want to do if this is what the state is pushing back on?
Well, the town says, you know, it does want to redo its outdated permit. The town's existing management plan was written in the early 1990s before 1994 state guidelines that restricted vehicle access to the flats. That's according to Edmund Coletta, the DEP. The big issues are erosion, pollution, and the impact on wildlife. Now, like I said, the town does want to, like, limit some access, and for instance, but they do want people to be able to get to the grants. There are actually 31 aquaculture grants at Crows Pasture mm-hmm. Beach, and so they want people to be able to get there, even if the piping plover chicks are present, by offering some protections like that type of escort vehicles. The town also does plan to cut down the maximum number of ORVs on off-road vehicles on the beach from 125 to 85, and that's because that's a nod to the increasing beach erosion.
We're going to speak now with Andy Tomolonis at SouthCoastToday.com. Good morning, Andy.
Hi, Steve.
Andy, a group of New Bedford fishermen met with wind turbine developers. It's a story I think we're going to be hearing more about. Tell us what happened at this meeting.
Well, yes. I'd like to go first, though, and let you know there's two stories right now regarding fishing and offshore wind. And one of the stories that's out today is the American Wind Energy Association. It's an industry trade group. They're circulating a video showing that the five wind turbines that are currently at work off Block Island, they're providing shelter and habitat for marine life. And so that's good news. Like any structure in the water, the turbines change currents. They create this hiding place, and, you know, small organisms and bait fish can hide there, and then big game fish follow to feed on that. And that's true with a lot of sports fishermen. And that's one kind of fishing. So that's good news for that. The bigger story, though, is that the commercial fishermen, you know, they're not really interested in that. They've got their own concerns, and some of them were aired this week in this meeting that was held Monday between the offshore wind developers and New Bedford and Rhode Island fishermen. So the fishermen are worried that these big turbines that are planned for the federal waters, these are the ones that are far away off the coast of Martha's Vineyard, that they'll block easy access to some of the fishing grounds. Some of them say that the turbines generate electricity that could affect their navigation equipment. That would make it difficult and potentially dangerous to cruise through an area where all these giant wind turbines are located. The turbines are big. They're huge monopile turbines. They're essentially a big pole that's, you know, pushed into the seabed, and the turbines are spaced a half a mile, or they will be spaced.
They will be. They're not there yet, right?
No, there's nothing there now. The only ones that are in the water are the ones off Block Island, mm-hmm. and they're a different kind of turbine. They have a pedestal that's on the ground with four legs, so that also would provide more shelter than a monopile. But I think we've heard studies from the North Sea and over in Europe that even the monopile turbines do provide some shelter for fish. That's not the concern. The concern from fishermen is a lot that they don't want to navigate around these things. Now, they're half a mile apart when they will be in the water. That's what the plans are. But still, the noise during construction, the noise during operation, the potential for, you know, affecting their navigation equipment could create problems in storms or fog. And so they don't want to travel through that area. There's also the cables, some concerns we've heard about cables. They're supposed to be placed in trenches 6 feet below the seabed. But there may be areas where rocks prevent that. And, you know, that's a concern, too.
For the commercial fishermen, because they'd be dragging through there or their nets?
Yeah, yeah. They might, right. That could happen. You know, the storms, who knows what would happen with a storm if the cable becomes uncovered. But they are pushed down 6 feet under the seabed for most part. Mm-hmm. Now, before these places were even designated as wind turbine areas, the Bureau of Ocean Management, BOEM, they took a look at a lot of these things and they held hearings. So they weren't placed. The areas are not placed on prime fishing grounds, but they are, you know, in areas that will be used to access them. And there are some fishing areas, some scallop areas that will have turbines on them, and there's a popular place for squid fishermen. So this meeting was between members of the Fisheries Working Group on Offshore Energy, and they're trying to get a science advisory board together to solve problems. It was held at SMAST, the School for Marine Science and Technology at UMass Dartmouth. And so information from this will be used by the scientists and the wind industry. They're going to try to find solutions, but some of the fishermen, you know, they still remain unconvinced.
Andy Tomolonis of South Coast Today. Andy, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Cindy McCormick of the Cape Cod Times. Cindy, a story that really seems to have touched a nerve. A local store sponsoring a contest for hunting coyotes. Last weekend, protesters turned out in numbers.
Yeah, about 70 people demonstrated in front of Powderhorn Outfitters in Hyannis to protest the store's coyote hunting contest. Now, there is a legal hunting season in Massachusetts. It goes from October to March. But the Powderhorn has now decided this year would hold its first coyote hunting contest that runs from January 18th to March 12th. And it's awarding cash prizes for hunters who bring in the largest coyote as well as the largest cumulative weight.
And the protesters are what are they saying? Tell us.
Well, many of the protesters told our reporter they disagreed with hunting coyotes for sport because they are rarely a source of food.
Yes.
And I know some people are upset because they look like dogs. Other people don't like coyotes because they have attack dogs. So it's one protester from Sandwich said it's killing for trophies. And she wore a camera around her neck and held a sign that said, "This is how real men shoot animals." Now, a man hired to provide security at Powderhorn provided a statement from the owner saying that they definitely uphold the right of people to express their opinions, but said they proudly support outdoors men and upholding the tradition of hunting.
And the contest continues for a little while longer, is that right?
Yeah, to March 12th. Now, it was interesting because the same day the protesters were at Powderhorn, carnivore biologist Jonathan Way was giving a coyote lecture at the Hyannis Public Library. And he was saying that you can't really count on hunting at all to regulate the coyote mm-hmm. population. According to Way, coyotes are territorial and they self-regulate their population in balance with their prey. He said the real issue is the laws concerning coyote hunting. Now, the protest was calm and peaceful, and the protesters were out in front while in the parking lot. Supporters of the hunt, many wearing camouflage, were enjoying a barbecue as the coyote kills were logged and weighed on the site. By the end of the day, there were at least six coyotes that had been logged in.
Hmm. Let's move on now. In Yarmouth, there's growing contention over what to do with a property that used to be a drive-in theater.
Yeah, this is on Route 28, and right now it's a 22-acre site. It's overgrown, and it's got a cracked parking lot. So the town has big plans for this property. They want to make it into a riverwalk park with a boardwalk. We think that neighbors would be thrilled about that, but they're concerned about the maintenance and the traffic will draw on possible vandalism. And Brian Colbell, he's president of the nearby Gateway Isles Association, said that the association was not necessarily opposed to earlier proposals, but they really have problems with this boardwalk. He said it's going to be 3/4 mile long. How's it going to be kept clean? How is vandalism going to be prevented? And pollution. He pointed to vandalism and litter at a boardwalk at Meadowbrook Conservation Area in West Yarmouth. And he also said, you know, the town hasn't been able to repair boardwalks at Bass Hole and Taylor Bray mm-hmm. Farm that were damaged in the January storm.
Once you build these boardwalks, then you have to maintain them through all the storms that come forward. Yes.
Right. And he has collected 299 petition signatures, which is enough to put an article seeking to block development of the property on the May 5th town meeting agenda. Now, the town plans for the sites include not just the boardwalk. They would like conceptual plans by an engineering group feature a welcome center, a playscape, an artist tent area, kayak rentals, and an 82-space parking lot. The price tag is estimated at $7 to $10 million.
In the meantime, they're planning to use this property for more short-term events. Is that right?
Yes. Yarmouth Selectmen said they'll be watching as an Irish festival planned for March 10th and 11th test the idea of using the site for short-term events. And Brian Colbell said the neighbors aren't opposed to that. They're not opposed to the short-term events.
Cindy, it appeared that the first medical marijuana dispensary on the Cape was very close to opening, but a fire in the building looks now to have delayed that.
Yeah, that was a fire last Friday that was that was deemed to be electrical and accidental by the Mashpee Deputy Fire Chief Jack Fallon. It's has delayed the opening. This fire started in a ceiling void space and caused a small blaze in an attic, according to the state fire marshal's office. It was really contained to the vestibule where the patients will show their state-issued medical marijuana cards in order to be buzzed into the main building. And the state fire marshal's office said the property damage is just about $25,000. But Triple M, which owns Jonathan Hurley, who's the CEO of Triple M, which owns a dispensary, said that the fire has delayed the planned March opening to the first or second week of April.
Hmm. I want to touch on another story that you did this week, Cindy, which is a story about a local veterans outreach center and a memorial walkway and a veteran who's looking to have that walkway preserved.
Well, the Cape and Islands Veterans Outreach Center moved from its Main Street location, Hyannis, to the Village Marketplace in late December. But the move left behind nearly 30 bricks dedicated to veterans of military service, both living and dead. And these bricks are located in a little plaza area right outside the building. Navy veteran Kathleen Silverwriter of Centerville purchased three of the bricks, and she's very concerned about what will happen to them. One of the bricks is dedicated to the memory of her husband, William Silverwriter, a Vietnam-era Navy veteran. He died in 2006 at age 59. She married him on Veterans Day, as a matter of fact, in 1994. Another brick that she purchased was for her son, Stephen Williams. He's an Army vet killed by a drunken driver in Arizona 5 years ago at age 39. She also purchased a brick for a young Army vet who had served in Iraq and was found dead in the woods in Hyannis 4 years ago. She said, "I don't want them left behind. It was kind of nice to walk in and be reminded that they once existed." She's concerned because the building is now for sale, and she didn't know what was going to happen to them.
So what does it look like is going to happen with these bricks now, or what are they proposing?
Well, at first, the Veterans Outreach Center, you know, reached out to people who were involved with this fundraiser for the Veterans Center, which was, you know, selling the bricks. But they didn't really get a lot of feedback. So now a board member, Robert Cirklis, said that he just decided to take the matter into his own hands, and he got permission from the landlord of their new building, the Williams Building Company, to install the bricks, which he plans to do in the spring. He said it's the right thing to do. And he promised that the chain of custody of the bricks would be protected. And interestingly, after the story ran, I got an email from someone at Cape Tech who said that the Cape Tech might be interested in trying to help this installation take place. Because the Veterans Outreach Center does, you know, counseling for people. It has a food pantry, but they just don't have a lot of extra money for landscaping services. So the Cape Tech might be involved in helping move these bricks.
Quickly, in the last minute we have left, I want to ask you about a nice story out today. It's about volunteers putting their sewing skills to use for newborns.
Yeah, these are called comfort cloths, and they are to help calm and babies born addicted to opioids, and also to create a bond between the mother and possibly the father. And what they're doing is an intergenerational sewing project that's going on between people at the Barnstable Senior Center and members of a 4-H sewing club that meets there about once a month on half days. So what they're doing is they're just rectangles of flannel, and they hem them, and then the mother holds this against her neck or her chest and puts it under the baby's head. And the baby also, and then cloths put under the baby's head are also held against the mother. And this project was started by a nurse and doctor at Cape Cod Hospital based on other research. And they said it's awesome.
People can look in the Cape Cod Times today to see that story. It's a great story. I want to thank my guest, Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. Thanks, Cindy.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thanks to all our other contributors. This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.